Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
In Denver, it's suddenly all hero schmiro regarding John McCain.
These times require more than a good soldier. They require a wise leader.
Have you noticed that right before they start bashing him, everyone says they're a friend of John McCain's and that he's an American hero? With Democrats like these, who needs swift boats? They're gloveless and punchy in Denver. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 28th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, a report on who's winning and who's losing in the American economy with author and activist Barbara Ehrenreich. Also, the latest from the Democrats in Denver as Barack Obama prepares to address more than 70,000 people on the 45th anniversary of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. And rumors abound about who John McCain will pick to be his vice presidential candidate. We'll sort it all out. Those stories and more. But first, these headlines.
At the Democratic National Convention yesterday, Hillary Clinton interrupted the delegate roll count in a dramatic moment.
I move Senator Barack Obama of Illinois be selected by this convention by acclamation as the nominee of the Democratic Party.
It wasn't exactly breaking news, but the hall erupted in celebrations. Then Bill Clinton took the stage with a glowing endorsement of Obama, and VP nominee Joe Biden delivered his own speech. He called John McCain a friend, but said his policies are just the Bush presidency all over again. The Russian president is in Tajikistan today for a summit with Asian countries. The Kremlin is looking for support for its military incursion into Georgia. French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner says the European Union is considering imposing sanctions on Russia over the crisis in Georgia.
Tropical storm Gustav has pounded Haiti and the Dominican Republic, and it's heading for the U.S. It could be a dangerous hurricane by this weekend. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal has declared a state of emergency and drawn up evacuation plans. Here is New Orleans resident Elaine Thompson-Williams.
When it's time to move, I'll just pack up and move and get out to safety.
Today, New Orleans residents are stocking up on emergency supplies. Barack Obama is in Denver at the Democratic Convention. He'll accept the party's nomination this evening. John McCain is taking the day off.
Jobless claims fell for the third week running. The Commerce Department says the nation's gross domestic product grew at 3.3% in the second quarter. That's far better than economists predicted, and the markets are reacting very, very positively, even in spite of the fact that Tropical Storm Gustav could hit more than 4,000 oil facilities in the Gulf. Oil prices are up a bit, but the Dow, nearly 1% yesterday, is poised to open higher at 11,502. The S&P also, the futures are up, set to open at 1281. And we're talking about Hurricane Katrina, and 3 years later, how ready are we for another storm that's churning through the Gulf?
Yeah, what have we learned? What did we learn about how the U.S. responded to that natural disaster? Give us your thoughts, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note at mytakeofthetakeaway.org.
3 years later, the storm that almost perfectly destroyed New Orleans. Your thoughts on if we're ready for another one at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
16 years ago, you gave me the profound honor to lead our party to victory and to lead our nation to a new era of peace and broadly shared prosperity. Together, We prevailed in a hard campaign in which the Republicans said I was too young and too inexperienced to be commander-in-chief.
It sounded familiar last night in Denver, and they were hoping that it turns out in November exactly what happened in 1992 when Clinton made it to the White House. Bill Clinton spoke before the convention last night and put to rest the case of Clinton v. Obama. They lined up their ducks and projected party unity. And then Joe Biden gave a speech last night in Denver focusing on John McCain. They're all ready for the speech tonight. Barack Obama will be in the Mile High Stadium. 75,000 people will be attending it. And if the stakes weren't high enough, it's 45 years to the day that Martin Luther King Jr. gave his I Have a Dream speech.
An historic nomination, the first African-American to be the nominee of a major political party in the United States. The first time the acceptance speech has been made in a stadium in front of 75,000 people. And as you just said, John, it's all happening 45 years ago to the day when Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. And Takeaway contributor and Essence Magazine senior editor Patrick Henry Bass is coming to us from Denver, where he's been covering the convention. He's also the author of the book Like a Mighty Stream, The March on Washington, August 28, 1963. And Patrick, what do you make of this, do we say coincidence?
It's a divine coincidence if it is. I mean, it's an amazing coincidence. I mean, just think that 45 years ago when Dr. King and nine other civil rights leaders convened on the and Lincoln, right in front of the Lincoln Memorial, that we still had legal segregation in this country. And the reason that the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom took place on Labor Day in 1963 was to get passage of a civil rights bill that would end legal segregation, which meant that schools for the blind were segregated, that, you know, African Americans could not go to some department stores and try on clothes. I mean, some of the laws then were just reprehensible. And to think 45 years later that we have an African American who is the presidential guy, you know, he's our Democratic leader, is phenomenal.
And there are some differences. I mean, certainly back then there were not great expectations for MLK's March on Washington. And today there are great expectations given just the sheer number of people who are going to be showing up.
Exactly. One of the things that I think people are missing in any discussion of the March on Washington is how many African-American leaders we had in 1963. There was Whitney Young. There was John Lewis. There was A. Philip Randolph. I mean, it wasn't just one guy. And so when the March on Washington happened, it had only been planned for 8 weeks. It wasn't anything that had been planned for a lifetime or, you know, for, you know, 2 years. I mean, it all came together rather quickly because of the brilliance of A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin. So when Dr. King talked about when there was a mention of the I Have a Dream speech, he had previewed a little bit of it in Chicago, but nothing like what we saw or what we now see, you know, in the videotapes and the reels from that day.
This date, though, of the Democratic nominee giving their acceptance speech was set more than a year ago, from what I understand. And back then, clearly no one knew who the nominee was going to be, or many thought that the nominee would be Senator Clinton. So it's really not, this has not been manipulated in some way. It just kind of turns out that Barack Obama got the nomination and he's speaking on this day.
Yeah, that's why I was saying that there's something about it that sort of seems divine. But I think that there's a huge, it's a tall order for Barack Obama. I mean, because I Have a Dream speech is now it's actually the most famous speech of the 20th century. Can we listen to a little bit of that? Here's Dr. King right now.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
Boy, stylistically, they couldn't be more different, these two, Patrick. I mean, the cadences of Dr. King are almost musical. And, you know, we got a professor up there tonight.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things, John, that also gets missing is, you know, some of the amazing speeches that were delivered that day. I mean, The day of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963, you had Mahalia Jackson singing. You had Marian Anderson, who had been banned from singing in front of the Lincoln Memorial by the Daughters of the American Revolution. She came back to sing. You know, Walter Reuther, who was a huge leader of the United Auto Workers, white guy, gave one of the most rousing speeches of the day. And had Dr. King not delivered I Have a Dream, people would still be talking about Walter Reuther's speech. John Lewis, you know, there was the Archbishop of the Archbishop of the day wanted to edit John Lewis's speech because he wanted to talk about, you know, the fieriness of a troop marching through Birmingham, and they thought that that was too incendiary. I mean, it was an amazing day of rhetoric, and I think that when we listen to Barack Obama, because we're missing orators like Dr. King, we think we're getting some of the best oratory of our day, but it really pales in comparison to Dr. King and some of those other speakers. I mean, Roy Wilkins from the NAACP was an amazing leader and a phenomenal speaker.
You speak about John Lewis, and as John mentioned earlier, Hockenberry, he is the bridge. He was there for the I Have a Dream speech, and he'll be there tonight for Barack Obama's acceptance speech.
And he was an early supporter of Hillary Clinton, which is very ironic. You know, it was only after Bill Clinton, you know, turned it out, as we will say, in South Carolina, you know, and started summoning Jesse Jackson, and some people would think race baiting, that John Lewis had a change of mind about Hillary Clinton, and reluctantly went to Barack Obama, I would say.
How do you think that Joe Biden set the stage for what we'll hear from Barack Obama tonight?
Well, last night, you know, it's very interesting that the Democratic Party has shifted so much. I mean, the Clinton era, you know, I think it was sort of a swan song for them, you know, over the past 2 days. And Joe Biden reminded us about the old Democratic Party, the Democratic Party of the working class, of the blue-collar guy, just looking at his mom up in the audience, looking at his wife who looks like no political wife. I mean, just the juxtaposition between the polish of Michelle Obama and, you know, Joe Biden's wife, you know.
That's interesting.
Stark contrast.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I'm interested in what you think, Patrick. I mean, we sort of dipped you right up to your eyeballs in lobbying and kind of the cynical sort of backstory of the convention. And here is this really important speech on this really historic day. How are you feeling just sort of emotionally about the significance of what Barack Obama is going to have to do tonight?
Well, just as an American, this is an amazing historic moment. Now, I think the plan is for me to go to some sports bar to hang out with regular folks, you know, instead of being at the stadium, or I may spend some time with the family just to sort of get their reaction. So as an American, I feel, you know, extremely moved by this moment. But as an African American, I have to say that this is probably one of the most significant experiences of my life. I never would have thought that this could have happened. And I'm not a cynic, you know, at heart. I'm a cockeyed optimist, but I just never thought that a guy named Barack Hussein Obama would be the Democratic, you know, nominee, you know, for the Democratic Party.
And as a student of American history and of African American history, what do you think this means for the African American community?
Adora, we shall see, right? I mean, because there are a lot of people who are calling this a Huxtable moment, as if it's, they're still comparing Barack and Michelle to sitcom characters, you know? So we shall see. What I'm thinking is that this has inspired all Americans. That's the great hope. And then Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech will have been fulfilled. We'll see in November.
Well, the bar is high for me because I don't buy any of this spontaneity of the convention, but I absolutely agree with you that the stakes couldn't be higher for Barack Obama. And this University of Chicago, and I attended the University of Chicago, professor is definitely going to have to step up. You have to convince me tomorrow, though.
Well, Patrick, I'll tell him that when I see him earlier today, that
Great.
He must do that. That John Hockenberry said, look, brother, you got big shoes to fill. Yeah.
Please record that conversation if you actually have it, all right?
As always,
that
I
will be
John,
historic.
As always.
All right, thank you, Patrick.
And good to hear you so optimistic.
I am pretty optimistic.
Patrick Henry Bass, thank you. Patrick Henry Bass is our takeaway contributor and a senior editor for Essence Magazine. And I actually love conventions. I love the Democratic Convention, the Republican Convention, because you're right, it's scripted, but we have a transparent system. For all our flaws in America, there are certainly many, and we talk about some of those every day, but yet and still, power passes in a very orderly manner, and we get to watch some of it.
Yeah, they're shaking hands behind the scenes, those lobbyists.
That's part of the system, and that's why they are our reform movement. Things change, John. But
right.
It's a good start.
Yeah, whatever.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. As Patrick Henry Bass spoke pretty eloquently just a moment ago, Barack Obama is going to have to address the nation tonight from Denver, and he's also going to have to speak very pragmatically to the urban poor and the middle class in the United States. And according to a new report from the Economic Policy Institute, worker productivity may have increased in the past 7 years, but real wages have dropped significantly. Some economists, in fact, say that productivity is just a measure of how much more companies are getting out of workers by paying them less. Any income growth, the report says, is mostly for people at the top 10th percentile of the income ladder. So we wondered what journalist, activist, and author Barbara Ehrenreich has been hearing in the convention rhetoric about the issue of poverty and the working poor. Her most recent book is This Land Is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation, and her book Nickel and Dimed was a chronicle and profile of the working poor in America. Barbara Ehrenreich, good morning.
Good to be with you again, John.
It's great to talk to you. You know, right out of your book, you talk about the Bureau of Labor Statistics reporting what the list of fastest growing jobs are. And one of the most disturbing statistics on that list is that very few of the jobs actually pay more than $30,000 a year. Can you describe your feelings when you went down that list?
Well, this has been going on for a while. We get the list of the fastest growing jobs, and a lot of them involve carrying a bedpan and a broom and a mop. You know, they're service jobs that are historically low paid. There was one interesting exception, college professors. Now, that took me by surprise. I don't know what they're going to be teaching people, you know, how better to scrub a floor or something, given what the trend in jobs is. But yeah, the jobs that have been growing tend to be very low-paid jobs, and yet, you know, young people by the millions are going to starting college again this week or next week in the hope that, you know, that will bring them into a secure middle-class lifestyle.
Certainly a lot of college students are taking a look at the financial problems in the financial industry and possibly not choosing investment banking as a career. But are you hearing in the political campaign this year the kind of talk or rhetoric that suggests that perhaps the government is ready to take the kinds of changes that would truly address some of the issues you talk about in your book?
Not enough of it. You know, I wish I did. I certainly will vote for Obama myself because McCain represents the upward redistributional politics of George Bush. You know, more tax cuts for the wealthy combined with cuts in services and programs that serve the middle class and the poor. So, you know, that's not a choice. Now, we'll see what Obama is going to talk about tonight. We've been told that he's going to talk about the middle class, which is now code for anybody outside of that top 10 or 1% that's been doing so fabulously well recently. And we'll see. I mean, he would need, for me, I would want to see some real passion and anger about what's been happening to the American middle class or to ordinary working people.
You know, in Nickel and Dimed, your great book about the people who are attempting to make ends meet on these kinds of salaries, is there any particular person or a story of an individual who you think would be particularly interested in what Barack Obama is going to say today, who maybe still believes that politics could be an answer to their own economic problems?
Well, the sad thing, John, is that most of the people I met while doing the research for Nickel and Dimed really didn't show any interest in politics. You know, it this was, you know, culminating in the 2000 election year, Gore versus Bush. And, you know, nobody ever brought it up. Nobody ever, you know, asked a question, made a comment, anything about that.
Now, is that because they're too busy to focus on politics or because of a cynicism they've given up?
Well, I think there's been a sense among the working poor, and this has been observed by many others, that it doesn't matter to them. It's not going to affect them. That nobody is really going to take their issues seriously enough. And, you know, that then a vicious cycle sets in because the candidates are saying, well, why bother with those people because they don't vote? Hmm. And those, quote, those people are saying, why vote? The candidates don't, you know, address our issues. That's what's been happening. I hope Obama can break through that.
Now, Obama's slogan is change we can believe in. And I'm wondering if that's radical enough for you.
It's pretty content free, you have to admit. I mean, change can mean almost anything. You know, we all know here it means change away from the Bush years. All right, that's good. But I'm not seeing a kind of a populist anger there. We saw, you know, we saw actually some of it in the primaries. John Edwards you know, Hillary Clinton picked up on it. To an extent, Obama, I'd never seen in recent years a crop of Democratic presidential candidates who were so militant about these economic issues. You know, Gore and Kerry, frankly, were not. Hmm. So I think that's a good sign. Now let's see if Obama can take it further.
Thank you, Barbara. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of This Land Is Their Land, Reports from a Divided Nation and the Classic Tale of Working America. Nickel and dime. You know, radicalism, as Barbara was pointing out, is kind of a dirty word in American politics, and it's hard to talk radically about economic reform without getting branded as some kind of, you know, Medvedev.
Yeah, which has nothing to do with the substance.
Right.
Of whatever the proposal is, addressing a specific solution, and that kind of word mastery, the spin from one side or the other, is really ruining a good debate sometimes about real issues.
Well, it's supposed to get pragmatic tonight in Denver. We will listen. And now Femi Oke is here with some headlines.
Thank you very much. Coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Tropical storm Gustav has rapidly gained strength this morning and is almost a hurricane again. The storm is headed towards Jamaica and forecasters say it will become a hurricane again later today. Gustav could hit the U.S. Gulf Coast this weekend. Barack Obama is the official Democratic nominee for president. He'll accept the nomination in a speech at a Denver football stadium in front of as many as 75,000 people. And it's a historic day. 45 years ago today, Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. Unemployment claims fell for the third time in a row, down from a six-year high. And the Commerce Department says the nation's gross domestic product grew at 3.3% rate in the second quarter, and that's far better than economists predicted. And in California, a jury will deliberate for a second day in the trial of Jose Luis Nazario, Jr. The ex-Marine is charged with killing two Iraqi detainees during his deployment in Fallujah 4 years ago. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
The Takeaway is, of course, always online. Tell me that fact you just repeated from 100 years ago.
Exactly 100 years ago, in 1908, when the
Democrats
first met for a national convention
in Denver.
Yes, African-American activists asked the party if they would put forth a stand against lynching.
And what happened?
Apparently, William Jennings Bryan, the Democratic nominee for president, he vetoed
that. Youngest nominee ever.
Because he was concerned about offending any of the solid South Democrats.
A lot of history, a lot of politics. You can find it all online where we're following the issues and the money. We're on YouTube, Twitter, and Friend Feed.
It's a very interesting story.
It is.
And tonight, 100 years later, presidential nominee, African-American Barack Obama, closes out the convention with a speech to roughly 70,000 people. But soon all the attention will turn to Republican John McCain and who he will choose for his running mate. There's been rumors and reports. And so we're turning to the New York Times' reporter Elizabeth Bue Miller for a brief on the candidates, or at least what we know about the potential candidates for vice presidential to become McCain's vice presidential mate. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
Very much like the Barack Obama campaign, the John McCain campaign has been very secretive about who he has chosen.
That's correct. There's just a handful of close aides who know, probably no more than three or four. We're told that Senator McCain made his decision yesterday, or at least earlier this week, and he's going to announce it tomorrow, Friday, in Dayton.
Any sense of who's on that short list? I mean, we've heard Tim Pawlenty, we've heard Mitt Romney.
That's right. I would say the top two contenders at this point that we know are Mitt Romney and Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota and the former governor of Massachusetts, who of course was one of Senator McCain's chief rivals for the nomination. The other name we keep hearing is Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, who's a former Democrat turned independent. It's unclear to me at this point how real this is. A lot of people close to the senator say he really, really wants to put Lieberman on the ticket. Other people say, well, they're just putting this out. Lieberman, of course, is pro-abortion rights, which would cause a negative explosion among the delegates at the Republican convention in Minneapolis, St. Paul next week.
And certainly something John McCain doesn't need right now. I mean, he's had a rough enough time with the base in the Republican Party to begin with.
That's true. So the political calculus here is, does Lieberman help you among independents, women, conservative Democrats by putting him on the ticket more than he hurts you, or does he alienate too much of the base, the conservative Christian base? So that's the calculus. Now, people close to McCain say that if he had his druthers, if there was no Republican Party to contend with, he would put Lieberman on the ticket, or possibly last week we were hearing Tom Ridge, former governor of Pennsylvania, who's also pro-abortion rights. So there's some question. McCain's a very independent guy. He's stubborn. I just don't know. I think he really does. He's very close to Senator Lieberman. They travel constantly together. They certainly see eye to eye on national security and foreign policy. They really do diverge on the social issues, though.
What do you think is most important to McCain in picking a candidate? Obviously, if you're saying that he and Lieberman are such close friends, that might be an important element. The question is, where does his stubbornness meet the political realities of trying to win an election?
Well, I've always been skeptical of people who say, well, he doesn't like Romney, he likes Lieberman, therefore he'll put Lieberman on the ticket. I think this is politics, this is business, this is not friendship. And if he likes Lieberman so much, well, then put him in the cabinet. But he does want to be comfortable with his nominee. But I really think in this, at this moment, as in all moments like this, the first calculation is do no harm. And in that sense, Pawlenty then is emerging because he would be in some ways a safe choice, although he's very young and he's inexperienced, certainly in national security. But I think that's where I think that's what people are telling McCain: do no harm, and maybe the guy will also help you a little bit.
What does Mitt Romney do for McCain?
With one word, Michigan. I mean, that's the theory anyway, that Mitt Romney, whose father was governor of Michigan many years ago, would help you bring in a very critical swing state. there are many who say that if McCain wins Michigan, he has a very good chance at winning the presidency. The question is, can Romney help you in Michigan? He certainly won during the primary.
Yeah, I mean, take the primary snapshot as a way of determining what might happen in November.
You can't tell because it's not a Republican primary; it's a general election. Romney won Michigan. He did very well in Michigan against McCain. One reason he did so well was that he went there and talked about the economy while McCain. And promised that things would get better. Well, McCain went there and was a bit of a cold glass of water and said that, look, I can't promise you that these jobs are coming back. He said it over and over again, and people didn't like hearing that. I was there during that primary battle, and it was not a popular message.
And Mitt Romney spent a lot of money in Michigan.
That's true. Mitt Romney spent tens of millions of dollars of his own money in the race. But they're going to be taking general election funds for the public funding for the general election. So there's a difference there too.
Okay, last question, Elizabeth. How are we going to find out? Is John McCain going to send a text?
No, he's not at this point, as we speak, I would say a totally internet savvy candidate. He gets emails printed out from his aides.
So smoke signals? It'll be smoke signals from a mesa
right,
in Arizona.
From Sedona, from his weekend, from his vacation home in Sedona.
No, really. How do you think we're going to find out?
I think we'll find out through leaks. I think we'll find out probably today or late tonight sometime. I hope we find out. Or if they're really good at this, we'll find out when the guy is on stage tomorrow.
When the guy is on stage, Elizabeth Buemuller. Thank you. Elizabeth is a reporter with our partner in the New York Times. And maybe we'll find out tomorrow who McCain chooses, or maybe we won't. But we will get some headlines right now from Femi. Okay. Femi?
Thank you very much. Coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. Bill Clinton gave a ringing endorsement last night for Barack Obama. The former president told delegates at the party's convention in Denver that Obama is ready. Barack Obama will make his acceptance speech tonight in a stadium before 75,000 people. The French foreign minister said that the EU is considering imposing sanctions against Russia over the crisis in Georgia, a reversal of its earlier position. Meanwhile, Russia has failed to receive support for its actions in Georgia at a meeting of its Asian neighbors. Tropical storm Gustav has rapidly gained strength this morning and is almost a hurricane again. The storm is on its way to Jamaica, and forecasters say it will become a hurricane later today. Earlier, forecasters were saying that wouldn't happen until tomorrow, which gives you an idea of how unpredictable tropical systems are. And we do need to be careful about saying where it is going on the Gulf Coast. And meanwhile, we talked about the Michael Phelps effect last week. Today he is going to be in New York at the 14th Street YMCA to talk about his swimming program. Michael Phelps will also make an appearance at the 2008 Video Music Awards. He announced he's writing a book this week, Busy Man, and hosting the very first edition of Saturday Night Live. And if you go to the Portrait Museum, the National Portrait Museum in D.C., you'll also see him on display there until January.
John McCain's Veep pick.
That would be news.
Thank you, Fem.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Barack Obama and Dr. Martin Luther King share a historical moment tonight, but in a way, the moments couldn't be more different. There were 200,000 people gathered at the base of the Lincoln Memorial when Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech 45 years ago today. King was at the head of a movement outside of any political party, challenging the status quo and attracting a spontaneous outpouring of Americans dreaming along with him.
Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time.
Today, Barack Obama, the first black man with a real shot at the presidency, will speak to 75,000 in a stadium. 75,000 mostly invited guests at the Democratic National Convention, a political party working within the system. Carefully scripted event. Spontaneity? Probably not. But Obama will be continuing a narrative begun a very long time ago.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
I don't know. It's always goosebumps when I hear that. And the following refrain is probably one of the most famous in American history. And look for a deliberate echo tonight in Denver.
From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California.
The consequences of that march on Washington included passage of the Civil Rights Act, something President Kennedy did not live to see. Barack Obama's campaign is also a consequence of that speech 45 years ago, something Dr. King did not live to see. But if you look in the crowd tonight, there will be faces who connect both events, like Congressman John Lewis, Julian Bond, others who are living echoes of that speech and a narrative that has forever changed the meaning of the words, I have a dream.
We will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
There's some measure to go before we are finally free, something Barack Obama may refer to tonight. Mile high in the snow-capped mountains of Colorado, as Dr. King referred, but 45 years after the speech, I Have a Dream.
Keep on a-talking, Lord, and marching up to freedom, Lord.
Hang on, I let no nervous Nelly, Lord,
turn me round.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, August 28th, and we have the very latest headlines for you from Femi Oke. Femi?
Thanks, Adora. Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Tropical storm Gustave is rapidly gaining strength this morning. The storm is heading towards Jamaica and the Cayman Islands today, and the U.S. Gulf Coast residents are bracing for the storm to hit this weekend. The U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan says it's killed 100 militants in 4 days of clashes in southern Helmand province. A spokesman says the fighting in the area continues and there are no civilian or coalition casualties so far. The Russian president is in Tajikistan today for a summit with Asian countries. The Kremlin is looking for support for its military incursion into Georgia. President Dmitry Medvedev says that China has expressed understanding for Russia's actions, but a Chinese foreign ministry spokesman says that it's giving a more restrained version of the China's stance on the crisis. And at the Democratic National Convention yesterday, Bill Clinton gave Barack Obama a glowing endorsement, ending fears that the former president wouldn't get behind his wife's rival. Democratic vice president candidate Joe Biden's speech was also very well received.
Again and again, John McCain has been wrong and Barack Obama is right.
Biden got a little bit of a theme going on, so the audience were very quick to join in.
John McCain was wrong and Barack Obama was right.
And by the end, it was almost like a nursery rhyme, everybody joining in.
Again! Again! And again! On the most important national security issues of our time, John McCain was wrong, and Barack Obama has been proven right.
Certainly got the crowd going. Barack Obama will appear tonight in Denver in front of an audience of about 75,000 people.
We'll see what taglines he has. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
And also on the minds of many today is the fact that tomorrow marks the third year anniversary since Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast. Today, here's some familiar sound from the cleanup in New Orleans. To another familiar sound from Grammy Award-winning musician and composer Terrence Blanchard. This is a common one, too. That's a track from A Tale of God's Will, a Requiem for Katrina by Terrence Blanchard. In his career, he's written over 30 movie scores, including the score for Inside Man, Malcolm X, 25th Hour, and The Summer of Stam, often working with Spike Lee. He is also a proud New Orleans native who spent the past 3 years working hard to rebuild New Orleans and keep its musical traditions strong. He joins us now from New Orleans. And Terrence, welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
we're very grateful to have you. Let's start with Tropical Storm Gustav. I mean, what's going through your head?
Well, we're all keeping our fingers crossed and saying our prayers that this thing will turn and hopefully head back out into the water and dissipate. But, you know, in the larger scheme of things, with most of us who are very thoughtful about the whole thing, we're looking at it as another test. I mean, you know, we have to wait and see what's going to happen with our levees. We've been hearing that the levees have been shored up by the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, but we won't know until we actually have another situation where they are tested, and it seems to be the one.
I would think that would make for some, you know, nerve-wracking times, although so much is uncertain at this point. But let's talk about how your life and your music changed after Katrina.
Well, it changed in a unusual way for me. I mean, you know, I'm an artist, and, you know, being an artist, we always make commentary on social issues. But I think the big difference is that after Katrina, we were all forced to realize that, you know, we didn't feel like our government had our backs. So a lot of us have become more active in the community, you know, doing things, you know, away from the government and trying to get things done on our own. I think that's probably the biggest difference, that's the biggest thing that's changed in my life. You know, I've always been active in the community, but, you know, in terms of funding programs that we're trying to do here, we're actually trying to raise the money ourselves instead of going to the federal government to help us. We're finding ways to do things without funding at all, you know.
And that would be, the example would be your Monk Institute, which actually used to be in Los Angeles, but you moved it back to New Orleans post-Katrina. Tell us about the Institute and what you are doing with it.
Well, the Institute, first of all, is a graduate program where Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter are on the board, two great musicians, also Ron Carter, another great musician. And we bring in students from all around the world. It's a two-year graduate program, but the reason why I wanted this program to be here in New Orleans is because the program itself has always had a serious commitment to a community service. And we take our students and we send them into the high schools and the middle schools to work with younger kids to help inspire them to play. And that's the reason why I really wanted the program here, because we could exist anywhere in terms of working with our graduate students. But I told the director, I said, you have to tell me what city is more deserving of this type of program with its commitment to community service than New Orleans. And
well, let's hear you jamming with some of those students a couple of years ago. Terrence, you remember that last year?
No.
But I guess a lot of things have been going through your mind a bit lately.
But having Monk in New Orleans raises a really interesting question. Dixieland jazz came very much out of a place in New Orleans. I'm wondering if the sense of place helps musicians in some way.
Oh, definitely. That was part of the reason. That was another reason why everybody was excited about moving here, because this is the birthplace of jazz. But the thing that's really great for our students is that, you know, they're giving to the community, but they're also getting something from it as well, because we still have a healthy music scene here. And they're going out and, you know, starting relationships with some very established and, you know, a very well-seasoned musicians. And they've been learning a great deal their first year here.
Let's get to your music. Let's talk about A Tale of God's Will, a requiem for Katrina, which actually won a Grammy. And you told me a couple of weeks ago that there are just some things that you can't put into words, but you can put into your music. Describe what this album means to you.
Oh, man. What it means to me is that, you know, it signifies the spirit and the courage of the citizens here, you know, because I've said, you know, I didn't feel like I won the Grammy. I felt like New Orleans won the Grammy, because basically I was just trying to tell their story, and I just tried to be a conduit for all of the people here who had stories to tell, because I kept hearing so many stories in the aftermath of the hurricane, and I tried to set those to music.
Let's listen to one of my favorites here. That's called The Funeral Dirge. Tell us what inspired you here.
Well, when Spike first started to show the footage to me, you know, when he came over to my home, actually, we didn't have much in the house because the refrigerator was all, you know, we had to throw that away. We had broken windows and we were cleaning up. My family was still in L.A. But Spike was here shooting the interviews, and he came over to the house to show me the first 2 hours. And when he got to the part where there were dead bodies that were, you know, all over the city, it really broke my heart. You know, it broke my heart to think that there was nobody here to rescue people and nobody here to take care of these fallen citizens, you know. And I wanted to do something that, A, gave them a proper burial, and B, showed their courage, you know. And because I looked at them as heroes, because some of those folks were people who were in the water trying to save other people and perished.
How are you going to spend the anniversary tomorrow, Terrence?
Well, you know, we're all going to be very reflective. I mean, you know, given that Gustav is out in the, you know, in the ocean, and tomorrow's at the anniversary, I know a lot of us are going to be reflecting on, you know, what happened and what's our future going to be like, you know. But the other thing, too, we are all very hopeful, because we do have a lot of positive things that have been happening here in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just going to keep our minds on those and keep pushing forward.
Terrence Blanchard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Terrence Blanchard, trumpeter, bandleader, arranger, film score composer, Grammy Award-winning artist, came to us from New Orleans.
And here echoes from that music of Terrence Blanchard as we think about the storm Gustav, which is making its way towards the Gulf, ironically and chillingly, almost exactly 3 years after Katrina hit. That's the takeaway for this hour.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.